two-part series on is there intelligent life in outer space? What this has to do with the Bible. I'll get into it. Yeah, I'll make it relevant. The same relevance why in next month we're going to start a two-part series on dinosaurs. Just to get into it, there's little doubt that the prospect of intelligent life existing in outer space has intrigued evolutionary scientists and movie makers for generations. And this intrigue, whether it's dinosaurs or aliens or something like that, it's fun to think about, excited, whatever. From way back in the 60s, I remember the first Star Trek series that came on, and they have a tendency to paint the aliens. There's a sameness and weirdness about it. One is they come in all sorts of colors and shapes and everything else, but they all happen to be some sort of human. They got the same emotions, the same ability to think and whatever. So the imagination hasn't really changed much, even with, I think, the modern series, Defiance, has the same thing, just colorful aliens in it. About the only way they've ventured off is in, like, the movie Starship Troopers, where all the aliens were bugs. They did go a little different direction on that. But pick up almost any evolution textbook, and you will find a reference to brief discussion of our whole chapter on extraterrestrial life. Several years ago, Carl Sagan, the late astronomer of Cornell University, raised private funding for a radio telescope that would search the skies daily for a message arriving from extraterrestrial beings. Sagan and Frank Drake were asked by the National Aeronautics and Space Administration to design an interstellar communication aimed specifically at extraterrestrials in hopes of letting them know we are here. So most of us remember the little plaque that came up with a man on it and a couple of other things. Consequently, attached to NASA's Pioneer 10 and 11 space probes in the 1970s were identical gold plaques inscribed with pictorial messages sent across the light years to explain Earth's civilization. Since that time, various other attempts have been made either to accept communications from alleged extraterrestrials or to communicate with them. Why the interest? There is an insidious little purpose to all this, which brings us into why we need to look what the Bible says. Obviously, I'm probably going to get more into the Bible next time than this. But this way, this period, we're going to look at a little bit more critical look at what is being said about extraterrestrial life. First of all, there are some who firmly believe in the existence of intelligent extraterrestrial life because they are convinced that if life evolved here, it not only could have evolved elsewhere, but must have done so. So it's an evolutionary plan or pattern or whatever is going along with evolution. If it occurred here, big if. We've already looked at it. There's not facts for it, but they're just going to say, okay, we're assuming that you're buying into evolution occurred here, so it must have occurred on other planets too. So Dr. Sagan was but one example of the evolutionists who followed this line of reasoning. In fact, if you ever saw his series, it was a lot of him in a supposed starship looking out at the universe, and it was a lot of ooh-ah special effects, but not much facts to it. In an interview in January 17th, a 1980 issue of New Scientist, Sagan made the following points. There is something like 10 to the 22nd power stars in the universe. Now, kind of toward the end of this, I'm going back and doing a little critique of all these things. But I thought perhaps as we go through it, we kind of critique as we go along. I love the big numbers. There was a saying in the military, if you can't dazzle them with brilliance, baffle them with, let the rest of it fade off. But that's what they're doing. They're throwing out big numbers, which look impressive, but what does the number mean? How do you know there's that many? And if you're really that comfortable with the number, why not a 2.3 in front of it or something to be a little bit more specific? I mean, when he goes, in about a million of these stars is the yellow dwarf like our sun. This means that there are about 10 to the 16th power sun-type stars in the universe. I mean, there's a big difference between those two numbers. But people just kind of let them slide because, it's kind of hard to figure out what those numbers are. Now he goes, now one in a million of these sun-type, sorry about the coughing, it's the product of the blood clots and stuff like that, and I apologize for interrupting occasionally through this, but there's an upside to it. I noticed that more and more people are waking up, as we go through the sermons. Yeah, nothing like a good cough in the ear in order to bring you out of your reveries. Now, it says, one in a million of these sun-type stars probably have a planetary system similar to that of our suns. Now, notice the use of the words probably. No facts. You're not saying that they have planetary, planets, like our Earth are around them. No, probably. It's just conjecture. Because we got so many numbers, the probability is, among all these numbers, there's something that's useful here. There could be an Earth-like thing. Similar to that of our suns. Therefore, there are about 10 to the 10th power planetary systems in our universe. Conjecture. Nobody sat there and counted them. I mean, we're talking deep space. Who can even see that far? One in a million of these planetary systems must have, not does have, must have. We're still talking probabilities. Must have a planet similar to that of Earth, and life must have evolved on these planets. What do you mean must have? We're not even sure it evolved on this planet. I mean, they're making claims here. They're putting out their positions and stuff with nothing to back it up. In the same manner in which it has evolved here on Earth, which hasn't been proved. I mean, nobody's witnessed evolution in progress as we go along. And to the contrary of the claims, nobody has shown evolution occurred in the laboratory. So therefore, there are at least 10,000 planets in the universe that have life on them. Man, that's a big claim with no facts whatsoever. Paul Davies, the renowned Australian physicist and cosmologist, stated in his book, Other Worlds, our galaxy, the Milky Way, contains about 100 billion stars grouped together in a gigantic spiral assembly typical of the billions of other galaxies scattered throughout the universe. Typical? Possibly. But they still haven't proved it yet. This means that there is nothing very special about the Earth. How come you haven't found one like it yet? In fact, there's a lot of scientists that say, one of the things we've gone through is that there's a new approach to this to show just how exacting the Earth is in, the kind of elements that make up our atoms, the minute, what do they call them, tolerances that are necessary in so many parts of our life. That if they varied, just a little bit, life would not be possible. In fact, one scientist said it's like the Earth was put together to support life, and man in particular. It didn't go over big with the evolutionists. This means, he goes on and be here, that there is nothing very special about the Earth, so probably, there's that word again, life is not a remarkable phenomenon either. How come you haven't found it anywhere? It would be surprising if life were not widespread throughout the cosmos, though it may be rather sparse. Okay, we throw in that rather sparse. We're going to see what sparse means, as we get into this, numbers of distance. But it would be surprising if life were not widespread. Surprising to who? You know, on what facts would it be make us unsurprised? Sir Fred Hoyle joins such thinkers in his book Life Cloud. He wrote, "With so many possible planetary systems, should we not expect inhabited planets to be moving around some of the nearby stars?" Well, we can kind of see the nearby stars. Not us so far. We certainly should. He comes to his own conclusion. Evidently, then, that it is evidence that some evolutionists believe intelligent life exists on other planets simply because evolution must work that way. You know, that's your prior. They believe in evolution, and they believe that it happened here with no facts, so therefore it must have happened on other planets too. Okay. You can't really build a system on speculation and make confident assertions about it. Now, you can start with bad facts. I know in mathematics, you can build worlds out of mathematics. And you can build bogus worlds out of mathematics. If you just want to start with the premise that 2 equals 1, you can come up with a whole universe. You know, it's going to be bogus, but you know, you make all sorts of assertions and logical conclusions and everything else. But if you start with bad stuff, you're going to come out with bad stuff. Garbage in, garbage out sort of theory. Second, now there's a second type of evolutionist. Okay, that's also interested in finding intelligent life in outer space. There are some who believe life will be found in outer space because life simply could not have just happened. That is, especially here on Earth, because they're looking at the complexity of life and go, man, nature wouldn't have come up with this. Far from invoking a creator, though, the intended point is simply that the available evidence indicates life is too complex to have occurred here on Earth by purely naturalistic processes. So, life must have evolved somewhere in outer space and been planted here. This is the view of Sir Francis Crick in his volume, Life Itself. Surprisingly, he admits, an honest man, armed with all the knowledge available to us now, could only state that in some sense, the origin of life appears at the moment to be almost miraculous. Now, he's taking the position opposite of the other guy. He says, yeah, life's just a mundane thing. But he says, yes, when I'm looking at it, it seems almost miraculous that it occurred on Earth. So what's his conclusion? Yet while acknowledging the impossibility of the accidental formation of life here on Earth, he refused to accept the idea of an intelligent creator and instead opted for what is referred to as directed panspermia. Okay. You take a camera and you go like this to get the wide view. That's panning. So you look at the universe and you go like this and you put seeds, the sperm out there. And it's directed. That is, as far as he's concerned, some intelligent life someplace else has come up with life and planted it among the stars, and that's his theory. That's also Richard Dawkins' theory, who's a big mouth concerning evolution nowadays. So this is the concept that life was planted on Earth by intelligent beings from somewhere in outer space. Now, this doesn't solve the problem. It just moves it to another planet. You know, how did that life, you know, get there? Third, there's another evolutionist from a different viewpoint. Without a doubt, some evolutionists are determined to believe in some form of intelligent extraterrestrial life because they are convinced this somehow will nullify creation. For example, in his book Signs of Life, Ian Ridpath suggested religions which contend that God made man in his own image could be severely shaken if we found another intellectual race made in a different image. Now, this is kind of the concept of the movie Paul, a movie which I never went to see, which I'd never gone to see, with Simon Pegg. I thought it'd be a comedy, but it's more of a commentary. of if aliens showed up, it would disprove the Bible and God and everything else. But there's another this statement here, and this is going to be the crux of our next lesson. If another intellectual race was found made in a different image, what would that image be? If it wasn't created in the image of God, it was created in some other image or formed in some other image, do we really want to contact this stuff? Jonathan Leonard likewise has shown his disdain for the concept of creation in his classic essay, Otherworldly Life. He said, scientists point out that there is nothing miraculous or unrepeatable about the appearance of life on Earth. Which scientists? Yeah, name a couple. What are their theories? What are their proofs? I mean, it's easy to throw this stuff out. Edgar Rice Burroughs was good at this. You know, putting life on Venus, life on Mars, life beyond the farthest star. You know, read some of his books. It's science fiction. It's making claims out of nothing except your imagination. And that's all these guys are doing. Nothing miraculous or unrepeatable about the appearance of life on Earth? Well, how come they haven't repeated it yet? They believe it would happen again given the same sufficient time and the same set of circumstances. It didn't happen the first time that way. What makes them think it's going to happen the second or third time? In fact, he goes on to say it would even happen under very different circumstances. But where you got proof for that? As you're looking at all these planets out there, all different shapes and sizes and everything else, why aren't they finding life on them? I mean, there's some planets of pure water, some of methane, some of who knows what goes on under the cloud layers and everything else, and the sandstorms. Further, he goes, there's no reason to believe that conditions in the atmosphere and oceans of the primitive Earth were modified by any outside power to make them favorable for the development of life. Well, it's here. How do you explain it being here? They just happen that way, and it's likely that life would have appeared even if conditions had been considerably different. Sometimes you got to ask, what are these guys smoking? I mean, there's no proof whatsoever. I mean, these are claims that have no basis of fact to them whatsoever. I mean, there's nothing even somebody's attempted in a laboratory to show, well, we could come up with a silicon life, based life form, given these conditions. Nobody's done that. Such writers believe if extraterrestrial life were discovered, it would somehow disprove the existence of a creator. And that's their whole purpose. That's why they're pushing the agenda. The more they can get the kids to believe and think and imagine about going to other worlds, and finding life there and whatever. Ron's already taken off. He was part of in fact, he gave me the this for it, of the next planned trip by people to Mars. And it's going to take a couple of months to get there under the worst conditions. And once you get there, there's nothing there waiting for you. And what the people have to live in that they go, is a condo no bigger than a porta potty. And they interview all these people that want to go, and they're all jazzed by, they'd be the first one on Mars and all this kind of stuff like that. And it hasn't dawned on them yet that once they get there, I give them 24 hours before they start wishing they were someplace else. Because there's nothing there. And that's important to conceive. We're kind of in a bottle. And it gets worse. Critique. What response should the creationists offer to these various evolutionary positions on the existence of intelligent life in outer space? First, let us note that any claims made concerning the existence of life in outer space are just that, what I took you through, claims. Go back to the statements and look at the word used, probably, at least, it would be surprising if... should we not expect? In their more candid moments, even evolutionists admit such. Michael Rowan Robinson of the University of London once commented, "From the almost imperceptible wanderings of several nearby stars, we can deduce that they have small companions." This is how they deduce this. They haven't actually seen it. You know, they start a little wobble in the star or something like that. So it must have a planet or something going around it. That, or something, you know, is, you know, sometimes overlooked, but it's the more probable. It says the masses of the companions deduced in this way are, with one exception, 1 or 2% of the sun's mass, that is 10 to 20 times the mass of Jupiter. Now, stop to think about what he's just said. Now, the ones we can know about are massive planets. Okay, we know, you know, you go to the moon, and the moon's gravity is 1/6 that of the Earth. So the astronaut gets out there and takes a flying leap, and he's like Superman, you know, because the gravity's smaller. Now, instead of being less than Earth, what if it's 10 times the gravity of Earth? How big is this jump going to be? In fact, you know, we see people in the little centrifuge getting ready for space flight, trying to, you know, equal the 4 or 5 G's that they're going to withstand as they take off, you know, their face, you know, pushes out of place and stuff like that. I once saw a documentary of a guy on a rocket sled. He was supposed to take the 4 or 5 G's as a test. And instead, the thing malfunctioned. And for a split second, and they had it on camera, he took about 12 G's. And he literally flattened out and then popped back out. The only lucky thing about this is it happened so quick, his body couldn't adjust to being made flat. And the only thing he got out of it was a nosebleed. But can you imagine being flattened out like that and held? What you'd end up is like a puddle. These planets will not sustain us on them. Such objects, he goes on to say, in fact, could be, instead of planets, tiny stars orbiting, you know, a bigger star, rather than planets, for they may be undergoing nuclear reactions in their core and may be turning into suns themselves because of their mass. This one exception is Barnard's star, the next closest to the sun after the Centauri system, 5 light-years away. Now, I'm going to dwell on light-years for a moment. Alpha Centauri is the closest star to us. It is 4 light-years away. That means going the speed of light, and light, you know, goes 186,000 miles a second. So going 186,000 miles a second, it still takes 4 years for light to get from Alpha Centauri to us. So if you're looking through your telescope and you see Alpha Centauri, you're actually looking at Alpha Centauri 4 years ago. Now you're looking back in time. Okay. Now, can we go light speed? Now the theory is the faster you go and the more you approach the speed of light, time begins to slow down. In fact, if you approach the speed of light, it begins to go in reverse, whatever. So it's kind of self-defeating, you know, whatever. But, you know, say at our best efforts we could go 1/4 the speed of light. You know, I've looked at various planetary, you know, engines and stuff like that, from, you know, putting up a sail and going by star blast or something like that, the winds that are out there, you know, using it as a sail, or ion thrusters, or, you know, strapping a nuclear bomb to your, you know, to your tail and setting it off and see how, you know, fast you can go. The fastest I'd ever seen anybody project is like 1/4 the speed of light. Okay, for us to go just to Alpha Centauri would take us about 16 years at that speed. To Barnard's star would take about 20 years. And we're not sure there's anything there waiting for us. In fact, it's a matter of dispute among astronomers whether it's a planet or not. In fact, he says, it's an act of faith based on a rather shaky probabilistic argument to say that other planets like Earth exist in the universe. So not all cosmologists agree on this stuff. Now, most of these quotations are taken from the 80s, so I decided to update it for you. This is from Popular Science, around 2000. Celestial giants. Astronomers were surprised to find there were three giant planets around one star. The three new planets contained at least five times as much mass as the nine planets of our own solar system. So they found some new planets, evidence, whatever. But as you look at them, planet A, the smallest one, right there, is roughly the size of Jupiter. So it doesn't look like a probability of a place we want to go. Yeah, and the other two just get progressively bigger. The distance away from us is 44 light years. Okay, so that's what their big hope was in about 2000. 44 light years times 4, make it 45, 90, 180 years to get there. Now, latest research that I could find online, the Kepler 62 system. Okay. Their planets are also bigger than ours. But they're looking for something that's kind of Earth-like. And so it's the last two on the end that are kind of Earth-like, 62E and F. E, they don't think is probable, although it's kind of blue like our planet. It's too blue. It's like it's covered with water. That's all that's on it is water. In F, well, they're not sure, but even if it's Earth-like, it's still a lot bigger than Jupiter. And this one's 1,200 light years away. So the closest planet that's kind of Earth-like, which is still too big, do the math, 5,000 years away travel. Yeah, we really do need things like warp speed, wormholes, stargates, in order to make the distance. But all that is science fiction. Second, let it be noted that the claims being made often are blatantly contradictory. We looked at these guys and they contradict one another. We're going to look at more contradictions next week. There will be more critique to follow in the next lesson. And really, we'll get into what the Bible has to say about it and give you some very thoughtful things to think about and include in any argument you get into with someone who thinks there's intelligent life in outer space. As an afterthought, though, in closing down, something not taken up by the thought of life from outer space is the type of character we talked about, made in what image? If we did contact something in outer space, what's it going to be like? Just hypothetically. In their book, Occult Shock and Psychic Forces, Clifford Wilson and John Weldon express their view that in light of supposed recorded contacts with UFOs, extraterrestrials would appear to be violent and hostile. Cattle mutilations, anal probes, that kind of stuff. Do we really want to let these people know we're here? I mean, it's assumed by a lot of these guys that if we contact life in outer space, they're going to be benevolent, they're going to be really nice, they're going to give us things that will improve our existence. Okay, let's rethink that. Is a thing going to make your life any better? I don't care if you got a better toaster than the one you've got now, or your car begins to hover and you can get out of the traffic, or you have a disintegrator ray other than a pistol. Is that going to make you a better person? That's the thinking. If these people from an intelligent life from outer space are going to give us something to make us better, how's it going to improve on what God has already given us? To make us robotic so we have no free will? to give us all a lobotomy so we walk around drooling and stuff like that, but we don't hurt each other? Or does it come down to giving us directions where we go about our daily life applying things that make us different and better than we are? Courses of instruction. I'll tell you something that's factual. When I was in Japan, in a restroom, on the wall, somebody had written in, "Is there any intelligent life in outer space?" Someone else had come in and penciled in under that, "Is there any intelligent life on Earth?" Someone following that came in and wrote, "Yes, but I'm just visiting." And it kind of boils down to that. That's almost like the gospel in a nutshell. Yeah, we've been visited by an intelligent life, far more wise than we are. And we don't listen to him. We've been visited by our Creator, the one who created everything, the universe, and we let it slide. We go on our lives, negating everything he did, especially like we talked about this morning, even sending his son to die for it. What alien planet's going to do that for you? And even if we were contacted by intelligent life from outer space, give a couple of months and we're going to, kind of treat them rudely the same way we do God. Once it becomes old, and not new and improved, we'll be looking for something else. Our task then is to realize the precious things we have now. To realize that, something other than us has contacted us from the very beginning, has been working with us to try to help us, to help ourselves, to be better people, to relate better to one another. And it's all in that small little book we call a Bible. It's the plan of life. It's the scheme of redemption. It's the blueprints for life itself. And people ignore it. Our task is not to give it the weight and due that what we have is a communication from God Almighty. And you know how intelligent he is? Okay, look at the different spaceships you see in all the movies. Some are really sleek. Some look like junk piles put together to kind of float around in space. What kind of starship does God use? Nothing. He gets around wherever he wants to go, and his angels do, without any conveyance whatsoever. That's how powerful he is. That's how intelligent he is. That's what a force his mind is. It's incredible. And what we should be getting out of the depth of space is just how powerful he is and the wisdom involved in all that he's created. And the Bible's going to explain what its purpose is. We'll get into next week. But for now, it's just an invitation. If you need to know more about the truth of God, of how to relate to him, about how to prove your life, I'd be happy to sit down with you. There's many of the men here, the women, that can sit down and take you through the course of the scriptures to show you the excellencies of God, which is what our task is, to proclaim those and to show you what life is really all about and how to become an inheritor not only of this time, but something that those that conjure up extraterrestrial life in outer space, what about eternal life in outer space? They don't even conceive of that, but God has and shows you how to become a part of it. So whatever your needs are, let us know as we stand to sing.